Today at Reader's Corner, Brendan Slocum, author of the novel The Violin Conspiracy. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. On today's program, Brendan Slocum talks with us about his debut novel, The Violin Conspiracy. The book centers on Ray McMillan. Of modest means and growing up black in rural North Carolina, Ray's future looks anything but bright. Yet Ray has an unlikely dream of becoming a world-class violinist. Battling his own humble upbringing, the racism that surrounds him, and even his own family doubts. But on the eve of his great debut, his great-great-grandfather's beat-up old fiddle, discovered to be a priceless Stradivarius, is stolen, threatening to dash his dream forever. Brendan Slocum holds a music education degree from the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. For more than 20 years, he has been a public and private school music educator and has performed with orchestras throughout Virginia, Maryland, and Washington, D.C. The Violin Conspiracy is his first novel. Brendan Slocum, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Brendan, I truly just so much loved your book. It's one of the best reads I've had in the last year or so. And I often save this for the last question, but I have so many questions, I'm afraid I'm not going to get it in. So I'm going to ask it first. And that is, you mentioned in the materials that I was sent that there's a next book in the offing. You're working on something. Is there any chance it's a sequel to The Violin Conspiracy?
There is zero chance that it is a sequel. Okay. It's a standalone book. Yeah. Nothing. Violin Conspiracy is done. One and done.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I say that because your protagonist, Ray, I just want to hang out with this guy. I mean, I just want to learn from him. I want to learn from his family, especially his grandma. I'll talk about that in a minute. But this is such a book about values. It's really a book that teaches people how values really come to be in real life. And that's the reason why by the end of the book, I thought, and I'm not going to give anything away, but there was just a glimmer of hope like, gee, I wonder if somebody's going to re-enter the second novel. But anyway, we've taken care of that. That's not going to happen. And I know your next book is going to be as good as this one is. So you're a violinist. And you're writing about a violinist, so you definitely followed what I understand to be one of the first rules of writing, write about something you know about. Could you tell us about your history? And just in case our listeners tuned in late and missed my introduction, where you've been performing in recent years?
Well, I started playing violin at age 9 in a public school music program in North Carolina, and I absolutely loved it. I took to it immediately, and I continued playing, you know, elementary school through junior high and high school. And then eventually it took me to college. And I can honestly say violin is the only reason I ended up going to college. I had zero intention of doing any further education until my teacher recommended that I audition at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro and major in music education. Didn't know what it was, but I said, okay, you know, I'll give it a shot. I got in, and, you know, that's where I really learned how to play the violin. And my teacher, Dr. Rochelle Vetter Huang, taught me not only to play the violin, but she also taught me how to teach. And it was the beginning of the journey that leads me to where I am right now.
Well, you know, Ray has a teacher who he's very close to. She's very important to him. Is that perhaps a takeoff on your real life experience here?
At 100%. I wanted to model Dr. Janice Stevens in the book after my teacher, Dr. Rochelle Vetter Huang, and I hope I did her justice.
Well, I don't know her, but it sure seems like you did her justice. I fell in love with the relationship that the two of you had over the course of the novel. You also teach, is that not right?
I do, yes. I was in the classroom for 20 plus years, but pre-pandemic, I started teaching privately. I left the public school system and started teaching privately. And my students right now, they have informed me that it's been exactly 6 weeks, Mr. Slocum, since we've seen you. And I'm like, okay, well, you're keeping track, so you must be practicing really hard. And I'm itching to get back to teaching my students.
That's great. The thing that surprised me about your musical career is that it seems to have veered off course from classical for a bit because you're also in a rock band. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I like to think that it's cool to do both at the same time. You know, I'm walking sure. and chewing gum at the same time. And my rock band, Geppetto's Wood, is, you know, we have a great time. The fun thing about that band is I'm the songwriter for the group, and I'm the lead singer, and I play keyboards. It's made up of former students of mine. So I taught them when they were, you know, learning everything. So I know their talent level. And now that they're adults, we can just have a great, great, great time performing. And, you know, post pandemic, we're expecting to get back into performing.
That is great. Was there some singular event that caused you to think about adding novelist to your bio in addition to all of the music background?
Yeah, a couple of things. It's called COVID-19. The COVID-19 just wreaked havoc on everybody across the world. And I was literally, you know, where all of my gigs had been canceled and, you know, no performances, no practicing, everything has stopped. And I'm sitting on my couch eating, getting fatter and fatter and fatter. And I'm like, I got to do something else. And when the events that took place with George Floyd happened, I figured this was the right time for people to receive stories like this and to really be able to relate and give validation to experiences like this.
Well, there's no question you've done that. Now let's go right to that subject. Racism raises its ugly head in your novel in more than one place. And I wonder if you could take us through your thinking, and maybe you just did, but take us through your thinking about the decision, how to handle those incidents when Ray, your protagonist, is confronted by racism personally, not so much the details of the incidents, but just your thinking about casting Ray in today's world. And I guess where I'm really going with this is that I wouldn't be shocked if you told us that some of the things that happened to Ray happened to you.
Well, I'm glad you're not going to be shocked, because all of the incidents that happened to Ray actually did happen to me. They're slightly modified, but those are true life events. And, In handling them, it's just it's a philosophy that I adopted really early on, and I wanted to make sure that Ray had the exact same philosophy. It's always about self-respect and just how you treat other people, regardless of how they treat you. You never know what's going on with someone. You never know what's happening in their life to make them act a certain way or treat you a certain way. And you know, I'm an eternal optimist, and it's just like, you know, there is hope. There's got to be hope. If I go through a situation like this, or if Ray goes through a situation like this, it's always possible to make it a little easier on the next person that has to go through something like this. And even the people that instigate these types of incidents, you know, maybe it'll make them think twice. This is what people feel when these types of things happen, and they do happen. So I just really wanted people to get a different perspective on events like this when they do take place.
Well, you did an excellent job of that. By the way, Grandma Nora seems to be one of the reasons why Ray learns how to handle these lessons. I picked up a quote from your book where she's talking to you. When you begin to hate them just because they hate you, you turn into them. Yeah, now, those are pretty powerful words. And she also gave you some lessons on respect, which you've just explained to us. I want to talk about Grandma Nora, though, because anybody reading this book is going to fall in love with Grandma Nora. And when I talk about a book that teaches values, it's Grandma Nora that's doing the teaching here. And in so many ways, I mean, it's her wisdom, her inspiration, her generosity toward you in particular. So did you also have a Grandma Nora in your life?
I did. It's my maternal grandma, Grandma Nora. She is exactly the way, even down to the pink and green hair rollers in her hair. That's the description of her 100%. And as I was writing her dialogue, I could feel her over my right shoulder, just, you know, whispering into my ear. And it was everything that she would have said. And yeah, she was a true life inspiration, the sweetest woman you've ever met in your life.
Wow. That's amazing. So Grandma Nora, as readers will learn, and it doesn't really spoil the book any, it's been in some of the advances, Grandma Nora gives Ray her great-grandfather's fiddle, and it turns out to play a major role in Ray's life because of its value. I wonder if you could talk about that violin, that class of violins, the history of them, again, I enjoyed learning more about classical music in your novel. So this will give our listeners who might have heard the word Stradivarius maybe pick up a few tips on just what that means.
All right. Yeah. Stradivarius is one of the, there's probably three types of violins in the world that are on par with the Stradivarius. And the Stradivarius is probably the most well-known. It is just an amazing instrument. It can do anything. If you are the worst player in the world, you can play in a Strad and you will sound like the best player in the world. It's like learning to drive on a Volkswagen versus learning to drive on a BMW. It's just crazy what these instruments can do. And the interesting thing, there's a couple of hundred of them left in the world right now. And no one really knows what makes them so unique and makes them just a phenomenal instrument. The only way to find out, you can test the varnish, you can test the wood, you can test the construction, but the only way to find out is to actually break one apart and examine it from the inside out. And no one is willing to break open a multi-million dollar instrument just to do that. But in terms of Ray being gifted this violin, no one really knows when he has it that it is a Stradivarius. No one knows. And that discovery comes later. But I think Grandma Nora really wants Ray to have this instrument because it symbolizes so much more. It symbolizes his heritage. And it's a part of his history that she really wants him to acknowledge. You know, it didn't go to any of her children because they just weren't interested. And, you know, Ray is all about violin. So it's really a learning opportunity for him as well. It's like a rite of passage, a historical rite of passage for him.
How many of those Stradivariuses are out there?
I think a little over 200.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
And the one that you're talking about in the book is worth $10 million roughly. So I assume that's what the rest of them are worth. Is that right?
Some are, you know, there's Strad cellos and violas and violins, and some are worth more than others. Some have been, are coming to the end of their playable lifespan. And, you know, some are just getting into their prime. So it really depends on the instrument.
So I want to talk about the violin case for a minute in which this Stradivarius sits. It's not your run of the mill violin case. it's alligator hide or alligator skin. And I wonder if you could share with us how the narrator explains this, because I think it tells us a little bit about slavery in the South.
Yeah, I wanted to use alligator because I actually had an alligator skin case, and I would just think the stories that this thing could tell. And in my research, you know, I was doing a lot of research about the location where the plantation was, and, you know, everything that happened and what they had to go through, and, you know, capturing and killing an alligator and using its hide because it's tough and everything, you know, you just having to worry about alligators in your everyday life. Who wants to do that? No, that's not fun. I got to look behind my back to see if there's an alligator coming up on me. But I think it gives a really good, some good insight into just what life was like. So you're telling me you had to trap and kill an alligator to, you know, and that's what you use to make a case with. And it's like, wow, you know, just the whole thing to me was just fascinating and life back then. And I really wanted to give a sense of realism for what slavery was like in American history. You know, when we're in school, it's like America has slaves, slaves pick cotton, and Abraham Lincoln freed the slaves. But there's so much more to the story of slavery in America than we are taught. And I really wanted a sense of realism. And there are a couple of chapters that really expand on that. And sometimes they may be a little bit difficult to read, but, you know, I'm going to push everybody to read through it and get through it and, you know, read those uncomfortable chapters. And it's really going to be eye-opening.
Well, unless I'm missing something, what you just described about what students should be taught, about what we all should learn, is unfortunately what has been called critical race theory these days. I don't get it, and we don't need to get into a long discussion of this, but I think you just gave the perfect answer to those who would question the teaching of those parts of our history that aren't so pleasant.
Right.
And
right.
It's the only way you learn from the past. Well, I want to talk about a section in the book where Ray that a classical violinist finds himself being typecast as a black classical violinist. And at one point, one of his invitations, and you'll have to tell us if I have a feeling this happened to you also, one of his invitations is, well, we'll do Gershwin. Well, the minute right. you think of Gershwin, among other things, you're thinking of Porgy and Bess. So right. I'm going to let you take it from there and explain this.
You know, I thought that was I toyed around with that section and whether or not I should include it, but it was something that happened to me. I was, you know, I was actually given the opportunity to conduct an orchestra, and you know, one of the pieces was I forget what it was, but it was some jazz piece. It may have been Gershwin, and the woman who offered me the baton was like, "Well, I'm sure you'd want to do this." And I just, "Why? No, I'd rather do the Schubert. What are you talking about?" But okay, you know, this is your thing, and I get it. I understand why you think that. And Ray's response to that was, when you read his response to it, you'll know what I'm talking about. But yeah, that one, I had so much fun doing that, because that's always what I wanted to say when someone would make a statement like that about, you know, me playing a certain type of music or me gravitating towards a certain type of music. And I'm glad I got to respond to those people vicariously through Ray.
No kidding. You're listening to A Classical Violinist by the name of Brendan Slocum, but he's now a novelist with his first-time novel out called The Violin Conspiracy. So Ray is preparing for the Tchaikovsky competition. I hate to admit this on the air, but I had to Google it. Isn't that sad? Isn't that sad, Brendan, that I
couldn't even figure that out?
But anyway, the Tchaikovsky competition, I think for those of us who are trained so poorly in music education as I am, why don't you tell us something about the event, and when is the last time an American won that grand prize? Of course, this is all now seen in a different light with Putin's attack on Ukraine. But
definitely. Yeah. The Tchaikovsky competition, I like to categorize it as the Olympics of classical music, because it happens every 4 years. It is one of the most prestigious competitions in the world for young musicians. There is an age limit. So, you know, you age out. I should know this because I did extensive research on it. I could tell you what they have for lunch on day two, but I couldn't tell you what age they age out at. They do it's several categories: strings, vocal, brass, piano. And it's very, very, very high level competition. And the last time an American won was in the 50s, a pianist, Van Cliburn, won. And that was the last time. So, you know, Ray going and representing America, not only as an American, but as a Black American, is huge. So, there are high stakes there in that aspect of the competition as well.
Yeah, that was a very exciting part of the book for me, and I'm sure it will be for all of our readers. At one point, the narrator, that would be you, the author, Brendan, reflects on the competition by saying that some claim only Russians can play Russian music. Mm-hmm. Tell us how Ray takes that.
Ray just doesn't get it. He's like, "What are you talking about? I don't need to be Russian to understand, you know, the anguish that you go through or the joy that you go through when you write or you perform a piece of music." He just thought that was crazy. And people just have these, you know, just bizarre ways of thinking about music, that only certain types of music are for certain people, and you should only gravitate towards what it is that your people are good at. And, you know, Ray, of course, thinks that that's rubbish. He's like, "I can play Tchaikovsky just as well as Mikhail, his arch nemesis in the story." You know, and I think that he's looking forward to the opportunity to prove a lot of people wrong. And, you know, I think that's a huge lesson. You know, people will look at certain people and say, "Oh, you're probably not good at this." There have been so many times that I've gone into performances and, you know, the conductor will give me quote unquote help because he doesn't think that I'm going to be capable of playing this music. And I'm like, "Dude, I've played this like 100 times. What are you talking about?" Yeah. And the person that you sat next to me to help me, I'm helping her because she doesn't know how to do this stuff. But, you know, I get where you're coming from, and hopefully that mindset will change.
So for those of us who are trying to understand classical music, the violin in particular, and how it's played, I'm referring to that section of your book where Dr. Janice Stevens, Ray's teacher and mentor, gives him some advice. She pulls him aside and helps him understand what makes music special. She calls it musicality. Mm-hmm. And said, Ray, you can connect emotionally with the music. And so if you're watching an orchestra play and you're watching violinists, is there some way you can help us lay people better understand the difference between somebody who has musicality and somebody who doesn't? Is it teachable? There's one question. Is it teachable, or does that just come with people who know how to, who just express their emotions more vividly than others?
That is a fantastic question. I truly think that, you can teach a lot of things, but there are levels of musicality. You know, you can tell someone play softer, play slower here, and it will do, you know, X, Y, and Z for the music. But a lot of people who have just innate musicality, they do these things naturally. And, you know, I'm not trying to toot my own horn or anything, but I've been told several times that I've got really good musicality. You know, my technique might not be as great as the best player in my studio, or, you know, I can't play double stops as well as someone else, but you will always feel what it is that I'm playing. And I get my audience to feel that same thing. If you're watching a violin section play, you know who's really into the music and who's just playing the notes. It's apparent. You can not only see it on their face, you can see it in their body, and it comes out through the music.
I'm Bob Custer, host of Reader's Corner. Today I'm speaking with Brendan Slocum, author of the novel The Violin Conspiracy, part literary thriller and part mystery. The book is a gripping coming-of-age story about the love of music and a young man's resilience. So the narrator recalls Ray's young life and his mother not understanding why Ray didn't want to play basketball and instead was alone in his room playing the violin. Is there a message there, perhaps the entire book, about where we place the emphasis on preparing kids for the rest of their lives?
I think so. And just for the record, mom in the book is not my mom. My mom was
I knew that. I'm glad you clarified that. We got to get that straight. That's not a very nice mommy.
No, she was not nice. But in a sense, I really wanted to leave her character open-ended. You know, I didn't give her a name. Yeah. Because, right. You know, certain people may have viewed mom's character as, well, she's just a mean, nasty woman. And some others may have thought, well, maybe this is her way of protecting him because she didn't think that he was going to be successful because she didn't understand what it is that he really wanted to do. She didn't get the classical music thing. So, you know, she didn't know how to support him. So she figured, yeah, I better discourage you from doing this before you get hurt. But I think the message is that truly music is for everyone, and don't shy away or don't discourage people just because it's not something that you would naturally gravitate towards. You know, had I not been exposed to Mozart in the third grade, I doubt that I would be doing what I'm doing right now. I highly doubt that I would be involved in any type of music education. But, you know, I was exposed to it and not because I just said to my mom, hey, mom, I want to, you know, bring me some classical music, put it in the house. No, it was nothing like that. It was just someone thought that it would be a good idea to expose me to this type of music. And it was one of the best things that ever happened to me. So, you know, don't deny anyone the opportunity to experience something new just because it's the unknown. Don't be afraid.
Yeah. Well, this really hit me personally. I have a grandson who plays the sax and he's in the high school band, but he also is a heck of a baseball player. He's tall and rangy and he pitches well, and he went out for the team and he didn't make it. And they called me to give me the bad news that this was a big deal for the family. And I said only one thing, don't give up the sax. And I guess my point was that sports is so overwhelming in our lives that some families seem to think that's the only way to be successful in life as far as their kids are concerned. And I don't know, I just thought there was a little bit of a message there that there's other ways to excel in life other than on a football field, basketball court, baseball mound, or whatever.
Yeah, anyway. there really is. I actually have a student right now who is, I mean, this kid is 12, but he's built like he's 16 and just, I mean, an incredible athlete, but he's also the most talented kid I have ever taught. You know, he's been playing under my tutelage for a little over a year now, and he's playing stuff that he shouldn't know how to play. And his parents, you know, of course they encourage the athletic side of him, but they also encourage the music side of him. You know, they pay for him to have two lessons a week with me. And it's just, you know, it's amazing the support that they give him. So yeah, keep it up. Whatever your kid loves to do, keep encouraging them.
So you dedicated your book to Kevin Slocum, and it's pretty obvious from what I read about Kevin and your family that you do come from a musical family. He was very talented, proficient in oboe and French horn. His way too short career in some ways looks very similar to yours. Could you tell us a little something about him?
Absolutely. Kevin was my youngest brother, and I was blessed with some musical ability. My sister was as well. She's a cellist and she's a doctor now, and you know, she still enjoys music. My youngest brother was by far the most talented of all of us. If I had an inkling of his talent, I would be in a major symphony. You know, I would be on a world stage right now. He was incredible. He could do anything. When I say anything, he could do it and he could do it well. He could compose, he could arrange, he could, you know, take a tune and turn it into just anything. He could take a classical piece of music and turn it into a rock song or turn it into a piece of jazz. It was just amazing what he could do. And the way that he thought about music was so different than my perspective on music. And I always loved listening to him. The only thing that we did not do very well was play duets. You know, I would play flute and he would play oboe and we would like play a Cimarosa duet and I would miss a rhythm and he would immediately call me on it. And he would miss a rhythm and I would immediately call him on it. And then we'd almost get into a fist fight. And then we're like, okay, we can't do this. This is not going to work. We're too professional. You know, we're both too stuck on our perfectionism. And but he just, I mean, I lost him to cancer last year and it was one of the biggest losses. You know, we did not have enough of his genius in the world. So I really wanted to dedicate this book to him.
Well, I'm glad that you did, and I'm glad you had a chance to share with us his beautiful, beautiful life. I think I have one last question that caught my eye somewhere, and I think it might have been not in your book or any of the preliminary materials, but another interview you gave where you commented on your writing, how you write. And I've talked to authors who will tell me they did 2 pages in the morning. From 9 to 12. It's like, really? It's going to take you 10 years to write a book if you do that. You seem to write at breakneck speed. Am I wrong about that? I think I saw something about your production ability, and it seems pretty good. I mean, you seem to write faster than most.
I do write fast. I think it has a lot to do with I'm very disciplined with my practicing. You know, I would sit down for 3.5 hours every day and practice. Yeah. So if I need to sit down and write for, you know, several hours, like 3-4 hours, that's totally fine. That's, you know, it's not a big deal. It's not a huge burden. I just block out the time. Normally after I exercise, I will write and then I'll go teach in the afternoon. But COVID was, a unique experience because I had nothing but time. For my second book, it was basically the same thing. I just would write in the mornings and, you know, I'd write from basically 10 to 1 and got my quota in for the day. I try to do 2,500 to 3,000 words a day. And my agent is really good. He sometimes edits for me on the fly so I can get stuff back and rewrite. And I just, hey, if I say, yeah, I'm going to get this book done by this date, I just knock it out.
Oh, that's just an amazing feat. I mean, in a sense, the book is about Ray, who claims he's a member of the tribe, the music tribe. You're a member of the music tribe, but now you're going to be a member of novelist tribe. And is there any way, I know I've already asked you about the second book, but are you at liberty to discuss what it's about?
Yeah, absolutely. I'd be happy to. I just turned the manuscript in a month ago and I got my latest round of revisions back from my editor yesterday, actually. And I have to go over those before I start doing my edits. It is called The Composer's Last Score, but don't worry. You don't have to be a musician to get it. It's not music overkill, I promise. It's about America's preeminent composer. He's bigger than Bach, Beethoven, Mozart put together across the world. His 150th anniversary celebration is coming up, and the family that runs his foundation, his descendants, are planning a worldwide celebration. So they hire a musicologist to do some research to help people understand why he was so closely connected to the Black community. And during his research, the musicologist discovers that this man may not have written any of his music, and that it was potentially appropriated from a Black woman who now we know would be living with autism. And the family will stop at nothing to keep this a secret.
Wow, that's really... When's this come out?
February 23.
Oh, well, I've got a little bit of wait for that. Well, Brendan, I can't say enough about The Violin Conspiracy. And now that I've heard about your second book, what's it going to be the name of it? What'd you say it was?
The Composer's Last Score.
The Composer's Last Score. We'll all watch for it. Brendan Slocum, author of the novel The Violin Conspiracy. I want to thank you so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
My absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, with production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.